My name is Barbara and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi, everybody. And my sobriety date is November 21st, 1979. And I am so grateful for that. And as you listen to my story, you'll probably agree with me that there is no explanation based on reason for that fact. I didn't follow all the directions. I just followed the one direction, don't drink and keep coming back. I didn't have a long drinking career. I didn't start early. In my family, the people that I knew that drank in my were people in my family that drank and got into trouble. And so I decided really early that probably I would be an alcoholic if I drank. And so I was almost legal and almost finished with college, well, a degree anyway, when I had my first drink. And I went out with a nice guy to a nice restaurant. I had nice wine, and I don't remember how I got home. So pretty much instant alcoholic. Funny thing is, that fear of being an alcoholic left. And I didn't remember that fear until I was about a year and a half sober. So that pretty much was the story of my drinking. I blacked out often. So I got into trouble. I started doing dangerous things. I woke up in places I didn't know where I was. But the really excellent thing is I didn't get hangovers. So that was not going to curb my drinking. And when I bought alcohol, I read the labels for how much alcohol it actually had in it. So my first buying trip, I got sherry because it's like way more than other wines. It has 18%, other ones only have 12. I still kind of get a little nauseous when I smell sherry. When I was buying, I thought the portion size might also be a problem, as you know, in my thinking, because there obviously needed to be a bottle for each one in the party. The idea of sharing a bottle never occurred to me. I met a guy who was with me. I was with him through most of my drinking. And I owe a debt of gratitude to him because he kept me from having a lot of consequences of my drinking. He provided some consequences as well. So it was, you know, that was balanced out maybe. I didn't, you know, I drank. I didn't have hangovers. I enjoyed that. And then things began to change. I didn't get home safely. You know, I woke up in a closet. And of all the clothes that were there, none of them were mine. So that was a problem. Then I started getting sick. I started having hangovers. So something had to change. A couple of things changed. One, I talked to a doctor and got some pills. And then I could mix pills and drinking. And I particularly used those when what's-his-name decided he didn't want to be with me anymore. So I would wash the pills down with alcohol, call him, and he would come rescue me. And I did that repeatedly. So eventually we got married. After a while, I got sick a lot, and when I would drink what seemed like just a really little bit of alcohol, I would be really sick the next day. I would have trouble getting up and around soon enough to like fix supper. So I needed to do something different. Now, I'll tell you, as Kathy mentioned, I got a job as a flight attendant. I'll tell you, one of the things, this is kind of the, not the drinking part, but the kind of ism part, the symptoms, other symptoms of our disease. The fellow that I was dating wanted to be married to a stewardess, or wanted to at least date a stewardess, so I became that. And it turns out that dating a stewardess and being married to a flight attendant are two entirely different things. And he really wasn't so interested in being married to a flight attendant. So that was inconvenient. But then he became a flight attendant too. So that was added to the adventure. I moved around a lot. I was looking for solutions. My job was 3 days on and 3 days off. So usually I was able to get drunk and get sober before it was time to go to work again. And I was a periodic drinker. More surprising to me than probably anybody else that occasionally I would just take drunk. I didn't plan it that way, it just happened. But to try to modify this, I sought other solutions. I went out to visit a cousin in San Diego, and she was locked up in a nut ward, and I was really jealous of her situation. She had somebody that took care of all of the cooking and cleaning. They had art classes. She had a wide variety of drugs available. And she could get time off to go get other drugs. So I went and visited her, and I crossed another line that I really didn't think I would cross. I started doing stuff that was illegal, and jeopardized my job, but it just didn't seem important at the time. But I was in California, so I bought a bunch of pot and took it back to New York and started selling just to a few close friends. And this helped a lot. This seemed to help the drinking problem. I didn't seem to need to get quite so sick, if I can mix things. And that continued. That helped me get through really till I learned about AA. I was feeling really useless and wanted to find something that would help me feel like I was doing something useful. My job certainly wasn't useful. I defined it the same way that they do pornography. You know, has no socially redeeming value. And I looked for something I could do that was useful. So I started working for the union and on the Health and Safety Committee. And the first assignment was to go to a seminar on alcoholism. It seems that there are some flight attendants who are alcoholics. And I wanted to help them. So I learned about alcoholism. And I would have gone to an AA meeting then, except that I had a party to go to. So the next day, while everybody had been at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was detoxing. And I tried, you know, at that point, I heard, well, it was Father Martin's Chalk Talk. If you've ever heard that, he goes through bunches of symptoms. And the only symptom that I could identify with was the blackouts. Otherwise, I thought I was fine. So I had the idea that, ooh, I better start watching my drinking or I could be an alcoholic. So I decided not to drink and only smoke. And that didn't work. And then I decided only to drink and not to smoke. I finally decided it was probably the Salems that were really giving me the most trouble. And so I would give those up. But I got involved with this, and I learned things that an active alcoholic should not know. And I began to spend a lot of time with recovering alcoholics. And I met this guy that was talking about that he had had some dental work done. And they had given him some nitrous oxide, something like that. And he was thinking about having all of his teeth pulled. Because if a little's good, more has got to be better. And I thought, I understand that. That makes perfect sense to me. So I talked to one of the women that was a recovering alcoholic, and I told her a little bit about my experience with alcohol and drugs and asked her if she thought that maybe I could possibly have a problem. And she said, well, I can't tell you if you're an alcoholic or not. You could go to some meetings and then you could learn whether you're an alcoholic or not. And I thought, well, she is a smart woman. She has met a lot of alcoholics. If I was an alcoholic, she would know it. So obviously I am not an alcoholic because she would know if I was. Only later did I learn that alcoholics don't tell you you're alcoholic. They invite you to meetings if they think that you might possibly. So, but I was right around in that neighborhood. And this is, you know, this is a time of year that I think back to, you know, 1979 at this point in time. I was, you know, skidding along the bottom. And I went to a meeting with some of those poor recovering alcoholics who really needed a meeting. And they read that part that says, our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics. And that really impressed me. I thought, you know, if I ever met somebody that needed this, I would certainly tell them to come. And it was several weeks later before I came. One of the things that that I had the idea that it was something to do with alcohol that was causing my problems. What's his name had enjoyed as much as he could stand. And so he was moved out. He moved out the first weekend in November. And I was really trying to control my drinking. And I would, especially when I was around these recovering alcoholics, because, you know, so, you know, I can still remember the half a glass of wine that I left on the table in that meeting, because it was really important that I left that half a glass of wine. But since since I knew that it was generally something to do with alcohol, I went to Al-Anon. And let me tell you, Al-Anon is wonderful. You can do these 12 growth steps and you never have to stop drinking. It is a fabulous deal. And I listen to these, mostly women, talk about why it's so hard for alcoholics to stay sober around the holidays, because it was getting around the holidays. And they didn't have a clue, poor things. And I realized I knew kind of too much. And this was a Monday night. They said, well, our next meeting is Friday. And, you know, you're welcome to come back. If you want to get a head start on this, there are some open AA meetings between now and Friday. And you could go to those open AA meetings and you could learn about this program. Okay. So I went. I made sure they all knew that I was visiting from Al-Anon. And I went, and along about Thursday night, what's-his-name was moving his stuff out of the house. And I was pacing back and forth in the house. I was going to an open AA meeting that night, and I knew that I was not going to be able to show up drunk and claim to be an Al-Anon. I mean, I was not stupid. So I also knew that it wasn't going to be very long before I was drunk anyway, whether I wanted to or not. So I went early to the meeting, and I was just about a pace and a half behind the guy unlocking the door, going into that meeting, and it was a speaker meeting, and somebody there gave me a copy of the 12 questions, and you know, there's one that's written like extra large right in the middle that says, do you envy people who can drink and not get into trouble? And that hit me square between the eyes, because when I drank, I got into trouble. And I listened to the speaker that night, and it was a perfect speaker for me. It was a woman who had come into the program about like me. She had come in about that age. She had gone to college. She had a job. She had had, you know, a lot of similar experiences. I was identifying with her right up until then she came in the program. And I thought, okay, now I'm going to find out what's happened. Then she talked about the next 12 years of her life where she was in and out of the program. She'd stay sober for a little while and she would get drunk and go to jail and fell off a balcony and had car wrecks and got beaten up, and none of that sounded good, but it sounded like somebody was reading my palm. You know, that you too can have this. And so I really did pay attention. Now, the next night I went back to Al-Anon. I had promised I would come, so I needed to go back to Al-Anon. And after the Al-Anon meeting, there was a late night, it was Friday night, so there was a late night, 10 o'clock, closed AA meeting. That's the first time that I went in and I identified myself as an alcoholic. And there was a woman there. Thanks. There was a woman there. She'd been sober about a year and a half. During her first year of sobriety, she bought alcohol 6 times and didn't drink it. I asked her to be my sponsor because she was a woman and she was sober and she had bought alcohol, but she didn't drink it. And that was, I thought that was plenty qualification for me. Now, that became my home group. By then, you know, I'd been coming around so much, nobody thought to offer me a desireship. My sponsor snuck one to me. And I began. I was really fortunate. This woman had a time to spend with me. Every evening when I got off work, I would meet her. We would visit until it was time to go to a meeting. We'd go to the meeting, and then it would be time. You know, I could go home, go to bed, get up, go to work the next morning, and stay at work until she got off work. I could call her, and she was active in service work. And so she took me along to whatever service she was doing. Sometimes it was painting the little building we met in, and sometimes it was a guy named David A. doing the concepts, talking about the concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I got a real broad exposure to AA. One of the things that caused a little bit of trouble is that when I detoxed, I got mobile. I kind of got mobile for the first time in years. So I was active, and since I was not really, you know, I didn't really have a husband right there, I thought it would be a good time to date. And it's wonderful because you're married, so nobody can really expect commitments. On the other hand, there's nobody at home, so you don't have to take care of a husband. It's fabulous. And it's just the thing for somebody who doesn't really want to look at themselves. I could get, you know, take a hostage for a weekend. A whole lot easier than I could tell any of the women, hey, I'm really hurting and I don't know what to do. So I started my step work, and I tried a step a month, because some guy was doing a step a month, but I stopped doing that after he got drunk. I wasn't supposed to do that. So I did really well on the steps, that there was something to write down, there was something to read. I don't know how many times my sponsor assigned me to read something for 30 days. Read the last page and a half of step two for 30 days. Read the story Freedom from Bondage every day for 30 days. So I did a lot of that kind of reading. And I did the best I could working steps. I came in with a lot of prejudice against religion, and my parents, the old church that I grew up in, and God were all mixed up together. So I was resistant to ideas of God. So I just kind of skip over those and go to the next one where there's a nice list to write. And then I would skip over and I would go to the next one where there's a nice list to write. So at about a year and a half sober, I was in real trouble. What's his name? And I got a divorce. I wasn't planning to, but I was about 90 days sober when I, you know, called a meeting and told him, you know, I was getting squared away, and that, you know, we could get back together. And he's, you know, kind of was curious, so you're not going to be drinking anymore at all. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be drugging anymore at all. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and he says, well, I can't imagine what we might have in common. So he said, you know, that as soon as I could, he'd like a divorce. It took me a year. He was very patient to wait for that and not hassle me and not fight with me about about that. So I had that time. I was going to 10, 11 meetings a week. 11 was kind of my usual thing, and I was going home and crying because there was something terribly wrong. And I thought maybe that in addition to being alcoholic, I might be crazy. Because I listened to people talk, tell their stories, and they would talk, it would like get 5 minutes till nine, and they would say, oh, and I got sober, and I got a sponsor, and I worked the steps, I got into service, and everything is great. And I thought, well, you know, that's not my experience. I've got a sponsor, I'm staying sober, everything is not great, I'm having a terrible time. I'm miserable. So, I thought there was something terribly wrong with me. I also wasn't very good at, you know, managing. At that time, I was dating a couple of fellas in AA. One of them had been coming around AA for a long time and would show up at my house drunk a lot. And that wasn't very good. Scared me to death. I was afraid he was going to go into DTs and die right there at my house, and I was going to have a... Oh, hard time explaining that. And then the other guy that I was dating, he'd been sober a long time. He was sober a long, long time. But every once in a while, he'd call me with a gun in his mouth, ready to blow his head off. And yeah, exactly. So, accidentally, these guys showed up at the same time at my house. So the next day, I checked myself into treatment. I had a job for the union at that point. My job was to find places that we could send those poor alcoholic flight attendants that would treat them properly. So I knew the proper place to go, and I went, and the nurse checking me in is asking, you know, so how long since your last drink? Well, about a year and a half. So what you been doing since then? Going to meetings. She says, I mean, what drugs have you been doing since you quit drinking? I told her, you cannot stay sober in AA if you do drugs. So she was really confused. What are you doing here? You haven't been doing drugs, you haven't been doing... And I said, I didn't know any place else to go. I know if I drink, I'll die, and I'm not ready to die. So I came here. And she said, well, we'll find you a bed, and somebody will talk to you on Monday. So... I stayed there, and what they did was really wonderful. They told me that I could start over in the steps without drinking. Somehow, in all the meetings I had been to, I had never realized that I didn't have to drink to start over in the steps. I felt like once you did them, then you had to drink if you wanted to start over. I thought it was a rule or something. But they said no. They started me over on the steps, and they had me writing about how my life was unmanageable when I drank. And then they had me write about how my life was unmanageable when I wasn't drinking. And then they had me write about how my life was unmanageable when there was a man in my life. And then they had me write about when my life was unmanageable when there wasn't a man in my life. So I did a lot of step one. Had a lot of step one. And I began to do some work on the pieces that I missed. Having some kind of understanding of a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. And I began to understand that, you know, if we can do step two, really do step two, there wouldn't be any more steps. It would just be that step and then That would be the end of it. We just, but we can't. So we have all of these other steps that help us out. So I started with Long's Peak. Long's Peak is in Colorado. And I went up, climbed up to about 11,000 feet. And Long's Peak goes up to 14,000 feet. But I was up there at the tree line, and I had Bill pack. I was planning to take several days being up there. But after lunch, I realized all the alcohol and drugs were at the bottom of the mountain. And so by the end of the day, so was I. And so, but that was a positive experience. That was a great day. It was a beautiful sight. And so that's where I began with that little meager beginning with an idea of a power greater than myself that was positive. Because the only powers greater than myself that I really knew before I got here were negative, under somebody's thumb. I remember in the grapevine, there was a little thing that was just beautiful. It said, I was my own God, I created my own kingdom, it was hell. And that's the way I was when I got here. And so starting to change that, starting to look at positive things. That was a good beginning. Realizing that I could have an understanding of God that was different than my parents. That created some trouble in my family. When I got sober, my family was really supportive. They really were glad to hear that I wasn't going to be drinking and drugging anymore. I did try to hide it from a lot, but I was also distant from them a lot. So they were really glad about that. But then when I started saying no to things that they wanted me to do and living by my own values, they weren't so supportive. They really liked it better whenever I complied. So we had difficulty. They gradually began to understand that I had to do some things differently. But then there's a lot of things that we just don't talk about. And religion, church, spirituality, that whole realm is part of that. So it makes my relationship with my mom now really flat-sided on one side. I was really fortunate to have a sponsor that provided me opportunities to experience other ways of thinking about spirituality, participate in other things. I was taught that, you know, they're really serious whenever they say we only know a little. And so I could reach outside of AA for some of my recovery, some of the changing. And so I've done that. I also have realized that I couldn't get everything done in one cycle through the steps. I got to a point one time where I decided I don't want to practice these principles in any more affairs, because every time, you know, I start and then I make the amends, and then by the afternoon, same day, I learn another thing that I'm powerless over and I have to start all over. Of course, at this point, I realized that, you know, now I see that, where am I going? I'm not going to go anywhere else. There's always going to be more to learn. But I got a really good foundation. I learned how to do the inventory out of the big book with start out with four columns and then end up with the fifth column whenever I do my step eight. I learned that that really works. It works now sometimes when I don't know exactly what answers, you know, what the problem is or what the answers are. I can do that. Sometimes just a step 10 doesn't seem like quite enough. It seems like I need to start all the way over. When I was about 4 years sober, I thought I was going to have to quit my job because I couldn't breathe. So I was ready to do that, and my sponsor said, well, maybe you could try something before you quit your job, since you don't have another job to go to. Before you quit your job, why not try working without smoking? Seemed like an odd idea to me. But because, you know, I was pure of thought. I wasn't going to be taking drugs so that I could go to work. It didn't occur to me that I was taking drugs so that I could smoke. So I used the steps to get off nicotine. And it was harder for me in some ways than getting off alcohol and drugs, partly because it was so incorporated into my life. You know, the alcohol and drugs were kind of set aside from the mainstream of my life. But the smoking, the nicotine, was incorporated in absolutely every area of my life. In fact, one day, I was just walking around my table, in, you know, coffee table, and I couldn't remember what I was supposed to be doing. But I was used to having, when I went from one activity to another activity, a cigarette was the bridge. And without that, all I needed to do was walk around the table. And so I was just walking around the table. It's really funny. I had been married. I was married again. I was married. I found, you know, boy meets girl on AA campus, love falls at first sight. He was so cute. And so I got married. And I was getting off cigarettes, and I had been married 33 days. And they said, oh, you really shouldn't do that. I mean, you've only been married 33 days, you really shouldn't do that. And I said, well, you know, would you tell somebody, oh, you've just gotten married, keep on drinking for a while. That'd be a good idea. Just keep on drinking. You don't want to stop drinking right after you get married. So I did, in fact, stay off the cigarettes, that marriage provided me an opportunity to have kids. That was a really important bit, because one of the last things in my drinking was I knew that I wanted kids, and I knew if I had kids I would hurt them. And that was a really thing that broke my heart. And so when I was sober and I was able to be, you know, nice to these little kids, one was six, one was eight, and then when we got a divorce, they were 10 and 12. And I really wanted to keep them and just get rid of their dad, but that never works, you know. But I'm ever so grateful to their mother because she provided me an opportunity to visit with them. She considered me a mother to them, a co-mother, and provided me an opportunity to visit with them. I went to her house, I visited with her, with the kids, and got some closure in that relationship. You know, at that age, kids can't drive. So I didn't see them very much, but the little boy came and visited when my parents celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary. And that was a really wonderful, wonderful thing. When I was about 10 years sober, I did a little more work in that area. I was able to volunteer to hold babies in the hospital. They let me come in and rock the babies, and of course my favorites were the ones that were detoxing. And I would hold them and I would tell them, you know, rarely did we see a person fail. And knowing that, you know, they have not known any sober time. And I remember one day, you know, I got to do all kinds of great things, like give them their first bath. And I was giving this guy a bath, and he was just in knots. I got him wrapped up, and I started washing his hair, and he relaxed. And I washed his hair just as long as I could and keep him warm. But it was such a wonderful thing for me to have that experience. It taught me the kind of nurturing that is healthy. The only kind of nurturing that I knew before was taking care of somebody, like doing for them what they ought to be doing for themselves, or making myself sick in order to do something for somebody. So in this situation, you know, all they needed me to do was take care of them for a couple hours. They had their parents that were going to take care of them. It was just a little time that either the baby was sick or mom was sick, so they needed a little extra help to take care of them. But eventually they were going to you know, they didn't need me to take them home with them, you know, with me. And that was good because I was going to be going to Paris the next day anyway. So you can't leave them in the closet with a bowl of Christmas. So that was a real learning for me, an important part of my growing, learning how to nurture and care for somebody. I had a wonderful time taking other people through the steps, mostly other women, and sharing with them learning how to use these tools, you know, so that whenever we have something going on, we can get these out of the box. We can change our relationships with people. There was a woman that came in on a card, you know, signing a court slip. That's what we did. So I got acquainted with her and eventually got to be her sponsor, and we worked together for about 10 years. And then she needed things that I couldn't provide, and so we were no longer sponsored. Now, recently, I've been able to visit with her, and so now she has 35 years sober. And she has sponsored a whole lot of women, and she is you know, the time that she has is a little bit less than the path that I'm on. She's a little farther down the road because she took care of her mom until her mom passed away a few months ago. And my mom is alive, and my brothers and I are working together to keep her in her home. And that's something I've never done before. And mom's never done it before. So we don't know how to do this. And so talking with Sonia and getting, you know, getting information about her experience has been really helpful. And it's one of those things that, you know, I am so glad that I didn't lie to her when I was sponsoring her, that I was honest with her, because I need all that stuff back now. And that's the greatest obligation that I have when I'm sponsoring somebody, is to be honest with them. And that's the thing that makes it so wonderful, because then on any given day, I may be the one that needs to hear. And if I haven't given honest, then I won't be able to get it back. So that's an important thing to me. Whenever I started making amends, I thought that what I was supposed to do is go back to all of the people that were in my life and talk to them until they were felt appropriately guilty. And there were particularly, you know, there were particularly some of these guys that I probably needed to talk to right away. And it seemed like that everybody that I wanted to talk to is the one that my sponsor said, you know, the greatest amends that you can make to them is just never darken their door again. And the people that I thought, oh, probably they don't even remember this, that was the ones that I had to go find them. So she had a different perspective on things. Now, when I was about 16 years sober, I got married again. I'll tell you, you know, it's one of these things that by the grace of God, with the help of the 12 steps and Alcoholics Anonymous, I got married. And by the grace of God, with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous and these 12 steps, I got divorced. And I did that. So when I was about 16 years sober, I got married. And it was an interesting thing. You know, I remember deciding one night, I'm going to do this. I bet there's something for me to learn. Which is the wrong reason to get married. I'll just tell you, you know, you read ahead. This fellow was a guy that I had an opportunity to marry when I was in college. But in college, I was smart enough to say no. He had gone to Canada. He got tired of being in the Navy and thought that it would be an excellent thing for me to come to Canada. And so, you know, as a young woman, I knew that was no good. So I thought that this is my second opportunity to have something that was an illusion and delusion and wishful thinking. And so I embarked upon that journey. When things weren't going very well, we went to marriage counseling. And he and the counselor thought that really the problem was I wasn't taking any drugs. And so that probably the marriage would go a lot better if I was taking some drugs. And they would be glad to provide these for me. And it occurred to me that probably if I had been able to live, you know, clean and sober without him, that probably that would be the best thing, is for me to get rid of him and continue to live clean and sober. I found that, you know, I believe it's really not that easy to stay drug-free in this society. When 9/11 happened, my job changed a lot. And I had a really hard time. And I particularly had a hard time being sober, because there weren't that many of us sober on the airplane. There were a lot of people that were medicated on the airplane. And so I was having a hard time. and eventually started getting sick. I got sick on the airplane, and then I started getting sick on the way to the airport. And so I was treated for PTSD. And once again, you know, the first thing they wanted to do was give me drugs, give me medication. And I talked to the counselor, and we agreed that if there wasn't any other way, you know, if there wasn't a way, if I wasn't responding to any other methods, that I agreed I would take medication. But I said, so that's, to me, that's really not the place to start. That's kind of the place to end. So I was in counseling for quite some time and got better. But one of the things that she told me that has been really, it's kind of the same thing that you guys tell me. You know, if I go back into a sick situation, the chances of me staying healthy are diminished. You know, if I go sit around in a bar, probably eventually I'm going to get tired of drinking Diet Coke. If I go into a place that there's abuse, if I go into a place that is unhealthy, that probably I'm not going to be able to maintain. And so I decided that I would take early retirement and not go back to work. And it was the best 3% I ever spent. They docked me from my pension, but it's well worth it. One of the things that you've taught me is to learn by the experience of others. When I came here, I had to experience everything myself before I would believe it was true. But y'all have taught me that I can learn from others. One of my coworkers was going to retire in January. And so it was like February or March. And I saw him still working. And I, you know, asked him, he said, well, the people had told him that if he just worked till June, that he could get a better retirement pension. Well, he died in May. And I learned from that experience that that whatever extra would have been there, I had the idea that getting a 35-year pin would be really nice. But you know what? Nobody has asked me where my 35-year pin is. You know? So it doesn't make any difference. My sobriety is a thing that's been important for me. I've had to make more than one choice to stay sober. I haven't gone back out and drank since my first sponsor, you know, slipped me that first 24-hour chip. I did pick up a second 24-hour chip. When my dad passed away, that was one of those times that I really wasn't sure that I would be able to walk through that experience sober. So I went to a meeting as soon as I could get to one, and I picked up a second desire chip because it was an important thing on that day to make a commitment to stay sober for the next 24 hours. And I carried that through that experience. I carried that coin until I slipped it behind his shoulder and let him have it. And that's something that I, you know, somebody showed me that I didn't have to drink to start over. I didn't have to drink to get a 24-hour chip. I just had to demonstrate that I wanted to stay sober for the next 24 hours. So I've gone through a lot of times that I've had to make the choice. One of the things that it says in our book is that we have to get rid of our old ideas, absolutely. And I didn't understand until I experienced it that it's not just one time. I have had to go through getting rid of my old ideas over and over and over again. Even now, I have to get rid of my old ideas. If I hold on to them, I believe I will drink again. I believe that I will die spiritually, if not physically. And so it's important for me to continually work the steps, continue to learn about the traditions and practice those in my life to try to get a handle on the concepts because they're really large. Reading about the history of AA has become important to me. Learning how to be in all different kinds of meetings has been important to me. Whenever I was 7 months sober, I got to go to the International Alcoholics Anonymous Convention in New Orleans. I tried to get to New Orleans my entire drinking career, but lo and behold, 7 months sober, there I am. And the most impressive part of that was the moment of silence. When we stood up together, 30,000 of us, and we were quiet. And that's where I really saw and heard a power greater than myself that could restore me somebody. Whoops. And continues to make a difference in my life and allow me to live free. Thank you. Wow.